Welcome, listeners, to The Agent's Angle. I'm Peter Palaiologos.
And I'm Jonathan Booker.
Football agency is an industry with unique characteristics where new trends and events always seem to arise during every transfer window.
On this episode of The Agent's Angle, we will be looking at a variety of topics affecting football and the football agent's world. From agents threatening to sue big clubs, the question of where the football agents are needed, the prospect of more than 10,000 new football agents, and people keeping their word in the transfer window.
All that to come on The Agent's Angle.
Now, Peter, I think there's only one place to start the show this week, and apologies for some listeners who, like me, either shudder or sigh when they hear the letters FFAR.
I know.
But matters relating to the new FIFA football agent regulations are back in the news. According to a FIFA release from the 10th of August, in the last couple of days at the time of recording, FIFA revealed the number of applicants for the second sitting of the agents exam in September this year. And that number is over 10,000 applicants.
Wow.
This is probably double what I was expecting, Peter, as I expected a number similar to the first sittings where there were 6,586 and with just over half of those candidates being successful. Thus, I expected the successful candidates to be replaced by new candidates, in addition to the ones who weren't successful to come back for another shot. In fact, some may have expected less candidates for the second sitting. What's your take on the story, Peter? Are you as surprised as I am by these figures?
Am I surprised? No, because although you mentioned about 6,800 enrolled for the first exam, I think it was about 3,800 that actually turned up. So there was a lot of people who decided probably they weren't ready. And that's maybe 2,000-3,000. So they've crossed over maybe to this new exam in 19th of September, I believe. But 10,000 overall, that's a huge number. So there's another 7,000 that have enrolled worldwide. Maybe people say 10,000 was not a lot, but I would say that is considerable. The agents world is intriguing. It's compelling. And there's opportunities for people to get involved in the worldwide football business. Because with the new FIFA regulation becomes more international in focus. And also people from smaller countries, I would say, want to get involved. And in terms of the first point, becoming more international, I recently read an article where in Sierra Leone, an academy called Star Sports welcomed two agents from Europe to scout talent, those agents being Bevan Dix and Peter Smith, and to bring those talented Sierra Leone players into Europe. And then I would also think about smaller markets as well, where agents from different countries would want to sit the exam. And in my region, being Australasia or the Pacific around here, countries like Vanuatu, Fiji, Solomon Islands, there's a lot of exciting players. And I think agents from those sort of countries will emerge. So am I surprised? No, when you look at the international perspective of the business.
We can all draw assumptions as to why and what may have triggered this large number of applicants. And without asking every applicant that exact question, all anyone, including ourselves, can do is try to make an educated guess. Now, taking into account the reported just over 3,100 who failed the first sitting, have they reapplied? Quite likely, as they would have invested time, money, and resources into studying for the first exam. Or they realised they didn't prep well enough for the first exam and they're preparing better this time around. But this still leaves over 7,200 more applicants. More applicants than the total for the first exam. Did the 52% pass rate encourage more applicants? As I thought from what we were led to believe by FIFA as far back as early 2022, this was going to be a very, very tough exam. Has the largely random nature of the exam, with all the questions being generated randomly, encouraged people to even try their luck to pass the exam? Or is it down to some element of desperation because it is the last exam before the new regulations are scheduled to be implemented in full? There's also the question, is there the gold rush factor? given the publicity the first exam received in the media. And as my eldest child reliably informs me, it may well be FOMO, the fear of missing out. Was the date of the first exam and the process in applying for the first exam effectively communicated by FIFA and national member associations? Because even before the deadline for the first exam, lots of people were asking when the exam was and how to apply for it. Dare I say another example of FIFA rushing the implementation process after so many delays in the development of the new regulations? Or is it the allure and fallacy that the football agent world is a place where the roads are paved with gold? Now, nothing can be further from the truth for a lot of people who are involved in the industry, can it? But to be quite honest, Peter, I don't know what has triggered such a large figure, as it appears the main concentrations of applicants for the second exam are geographically similar to what was reported for the first sitting of the exam.
Very good points. And there's a lot of, you know, FOMO. I agree with FOMO. People fear of missing out. We have that sort of concept in Australia as well. It may be there's a bigger spread of agents globally. It's interesting that Germany is not holding the exam. So that's a big top five market of agents that will not be sitting. But still, there are big countries, England, Brazil, Netherlands, Argentina, the USA always has a lot of applicants. So does Belgium. So, and then there are another 150 countries or applicants from 150 countries that have applied. So that's quite a big spread, including in Asia and Africa. And also, I think you mentioned the pass rate. 52%. We had some new figures come in that in Scotland, 70% pass, whereas in the Netherlands, 47.5% pass. So there is a bit of a variance pass rates in different countries. But the 52% benchmark pass rate of FIFA, I think, would have said to a lot of people, it's not that hard, half pass, I'll give it another go. And it's not just about agents, though, because we've got to look at the player side and the club side. That is not growing. And that's interesting because there's only a limited amount of players. So who are all these agents going to represent? And also clubs. The only pathway I see that's growing is the women's game. There'll be a lot more professional opportunities and more players. So there'll be more players to represent on that side. But it's also a bit of a trend now that agency can take you to other places. I want to briefly raise one now, where we're seeing some big agents becoming sporting directors. And I'll just mention two, because I think it's a topic in itself for the future. But we had Ajax Amsterdam appoint Alex Kroijs as the new CEO to take over from Edward van der Sar. And Mr. Kroijs was the co-founder of SCG Football, one of the biggest football management agencies in the Netherlands, as well as Europe. And we also had the famous Portuguese player, I think was born in Brazil, Deco, who represented players like Rafinha, and he became an agent. But now he's become a football director with Barcelona. And as part of that transition, the Barcelona president, Juan Laporta, said, you have to give up your current agency role to be able to join Barcelona. So there are other aspirational avenues for agents to move into, especially in the sport director space and the scouting space. So it's a compelling, enticing industry. 10,000, big number.
And just going back to that figure of applicant for that second sitting of the FIFA football agents exams, there is, of course, another element to consider here. That is the ramifications from the ongoing challenges to these regulations. So the question has to be asked, like you mentioned Germany and not holding the exam, as far as we understand. What happens if the FFAR are delayed or even blocked altogether by one of the many legal challenges, including that injunction in Germany? Will the successful applicants from the first two exams be licensed? And if so, under what regulations? As the regulations on which they pass the exam will effectively be null and void in full, more than likely in part. Will they be reimbursed their exam fees and the time wasted for studying, the actual license fees themselves? And who will that be reimbursed by? As one of those sets of fees is paid to the national associations for hosting the exam, and the latter one, the actual license fees, is paid to FIFA. Will existing representation agreements from intermediaries, their contracts, will they endure? What happens to any rep agreement that was concluded in 2023 that has been specifically tailored to the FFAR? Now, what happens if the FFAR are blocked or deemed unworkable in some territories is a big problem. Will agents in those territories be permitted to operate from a national perspective without a license? Will FIFA-licensed agents from elsewhere be able to operate in those territories? Will legally binding representation agreements conflict between the different territories and the different licensing regimes? And if national legislation is not in place, will national football associations actually be subject to sanctions by FIFA if they don't go along with the FFAR in full? And a big question, and I know there's lots of questions, although FIFA has said it won't happen, what happens if national associations decide to levy a charge to be licensed and registered as an agent nationally? FIFA has said it won't happen. Will FIFA then reimburse the cost to the agents from the national association? This is a real minefield of uncertainty and lacks any form of clarity, Peter.
It does. I mean, there's a lot of issues that you just raised there, a lot of legal issues being conflicts with national laws, cross-border disputes, FIFA being able to go ahead as a regulator in all the markets, especially if there's injunctions or there's litigation on foot. What about unlicensed agents who are still working in the space or have they haven't transitioned across, but if they're in countries where the FIFA regulation may not apply? There's a whole gamut of issues there. And I think this topic in itself will probably be able to be ventilated more in October, November, when regulations kick in officially, or the licensing parts come in the sense of the licensing and the exams, but pretty much...
Or not, as the case may be.
Or not, as the case may be, but the rest of the regulations will kick in the 1st of October. I think in terms of what you've just raised, it's a topic for the October, November, when we'll know what the effect of all this is, especially in countries where there's uncertainty or the national laws or courts have said no to FIFA, FFAR. So I think it's probably best to look at this aspect then. As it is, the exam, the age of development education is something also we need to look at. And I think we can schedule that as a future episode on the agent's angle. And when I say agent education, I'm talking about CPD or continuous professional development, which is going to be part of the ongoing license from October. So both topics, one's for the future. I want to turn our attention to another interesting article where an agent's threatening to sue a mega club. Now, this is another story that overlaps into the upheaval of the FFAR and aspects of agent regulations past, present, and future. It relates to a report involving a player in a club synonymous with transfer sagas, rumours, and some frustration for all involved. As we said before, we don't look too much at transfer speculation. This is the agent's angle. We're about agent stories, trends, what's happening, the business, all about agents. But this story is interesting as it appears to be a rumor of an agent suing a club over the division of a transfer fee that was allegedly agreed. But then it seems a player was released as a free agent, but no transfer fee. And we're talking about the story that relates to Ousmane Dembele and Barcelona. I don't know whether you want to expand a little bit on this, Jonathan.
It's a tricky one because since we put this on the agenda for the podcast, the story has developed yet further. And between the time we record it and when it goes out, no doubt it will develop further and further. But from all reports coming out, it does sound a peculiar one and a messy one. And that's got even messier in recent days, as there seems to be claims from one side that counter the claims from the other that have already been made. And these revelations seem to be now a bit of tit for tat and bickering, but we need to look at the topic and the subject from both sides. But at the centre of this is a very talented player whose career seems to have been in limbo for some time. And I think he needs some certainty and stability without all of these distractions. So there is a lot of contradictory information flying around at the moment. It may well change. So the questions here are, one, is there a transfer fee with the player's supposed move from Barcelona to PSG? Or is it just an amicable separation and release? Or two, as was originally reported, is there a transfer fee, which was rumoured to be around about 50.4 million euros, being split between Barcelona and the player? Now, there in itself, and I can hear the cogs ticking, Peter, with you, is there a question over breaches of FIFA regulations, past, present or future, when it comes to players receiving part of the transfer fee? It's a debate that's been going on for years. Now, we have what appears to be differing reports from the two sides, from the club and from the agent, on the basis of the fee due to the agent. Now, the new parts that have come out in recent days is that this dispute relates to a bonus or performance-related element for the player in terms of his playing time that was not achieved due to an injury, for which the agent is reportedly blaming club staff for the injury and therefore the performance criteria not being met. And thus we have to ask, is that actually due from the club or due from the player to the agent? And we can't tell that until we actually see the actual agreement, and we're probably never going to see that. Or is it based on something in relation to the original contract in terms of the transfer or release of the player that may be due from the player or the club to the agent? We simply do not know. So we've got to try and read between the lines on this one. And from the most recent reports, and this is based on a quote from Barcelona, the club has reportedly stated, and I quote, "The club, in strict compliance with the agreement, has not negotiated or agreed with third parties the terms of this disassociation." And by disassociation, I'm guessing the club mean a release of some kind. So the question is, has the player now agreed a release from the club without the agent being involved? Which in a lot of cases is perfectly justified in doing so. Yes, the statements from the club regarding the transfer that were originally made, they said there was a transfer fee and then there was a revised statement along the lines of a release. And there may have been even misinterpretation within the club itself. But in looking at the broader aspects of this issue, it does seem to come down to a very complex agreement between the parties. But it does seem they actually agree on one thing, and that is they disagree over the interpretation of the agreements. And we go back to the legal perspective, how important it is for agents and players and clubs to have that independent legal advice. Will we ever know the truth in this case? I doubt it. It may well be settled behind closed doors. And if they want a football mediator to work on it, I'm more than happy to see if I can assist. But the question I have is more a legal one and a regulatory one for you, Peter. The agent is allegedly threatening to sue the club. So how will this sit in regards to it being a football dispute between two football participants and also the Spanish legal system? Is it seen as a dispute with an international dimension, with PSG's involvement, and thus it goes to FIFA? Could it even be the case for the new agent chamber as part of FIFA's new football tribunal structure? If it is not adjudged to be of an international dimension, will the Spanish DRC hear it from within football? Also, could this even degenerate further into a dispute between the agent and the player if the amounts are then argued they're due from the player to the agent as part of the agreement and not the club? So there's a lot to consider there, Peter. I've thrown you several curveballs as a legal expert for you to try and address. So off you go. Have fun.
This is a very complicated matter in the sense that there's a lot of, as you say, curveballs up in the air. Now, obviously, Dembele's an international player, being French, so it possibly be FIFA can be involved depending on the agreement. The Football Tribunal may be involved. I mean, obviously, the DRC, the Dispute Resolution Chamber can be involved, but it all depends how this agreement was developed. Were there also lawyers involved? What are the clauses? What are the termination, the breach, the transfer, the release? There's a lot of factors there. Also, I just want to go to the article. There's another article, and this is from more maybe the player side, and it's the article's name, Dembele's agent made an absurd request to Barcelona for contract renewal. And the article was in Barça Universal. I just want to mention a couple of quotes here. It mentions in this article that a 50.4 million euros, Barcelona were going to receive about 35.4 million. The rest will go to the player. But there was also a request by Dembele's agent, Mr. Sissoko, to renew the contract. So we're talking about renewal, and then we're talking, and Dembele's moved on. So it's a bit difficult.
I said it was messy and peculiar.
Totally messy. Now, it talks about variables. Now, Dembele's agent mentions that Dembele would have met the variables. Well, when we talk about variables, we're talking about bonuses. They could be assists. They could be other incentives for the player to meet match appearances. If they met those at certain averages or certain amounts, then they would get extra bonus payments, etc. And it mentions in this article that the football agent told Barcelona that those responsible for the kits and accessories the night that Dembele got injured, the leg warmers to carry out, didn't provide with the leg warmers to carry up the warm-up prior to the game. And this is why the forward, as in Dembele, had limped off injured in only the 26th minute. So basically, the agents put forward the argument that the injury was not a fault of his client, instead pushed it on Barcelona's kit men. If I'm quoting the article. So in negotiating an extension, the agent also wanted the variables to be paid out. So, and now we're talking about the player moving on and there being in a dispute from different angles, very messy situation. For lawyers, they would come in and unpack this and see what exactly is the disputes, what has been breached. However, based on the articles that we've seen, Jonathan, it's very hard to understand. We've obviously seen Barcelona's
view. It's quite simply a mess. And I think the lawyers are going to do very well out of it because this is a very complex one. And then there's always a chance that no matter how it's resolved, it then goes further. It might end up at CAS and it ends up getting very, very costly, very, very messy. And we go back to what we've said on previous episodes. Have things sorted out at the start. Have the interpretation sorted out at the start. Make it as clear as possible. Somebody might have been muddy in the waters here. We do not know. We do not have that information. So it's going to be a messy one, a really messy one. And then we're back to the question of what happens come October the 1st if FFAR is in force. So one who's going to deal with the dispute, under what regulations, at what time, and so on and so forth, not least if FFAR is in force in Spain compared to other territories. It's just a huge mess. And we're only basing this on probably the first week of reports coming out on this story.
And conflicting reports of that sort of.
Oh, yeah. But we've got to try and represent both sides of the story and try and be fair on the information that's available, even if it saves another agent or another player or another club getting involved in a similar sort of mess, because it does none of them any favours in this.
No, and this is, I mean, we're not here to give any advice out there, but what we can say is in complicated type matters like this, the agent probably needs to work with a football lawyer as well in order to make sure at the start of the agreement, when you negotiate this agreement, and especially when you've got variables and other types of more complex arrangements and incentives, you need to get them down pat. And I know that happens a lot in the Premier League. It happens a lot in Spain, happens a lot with these bigger name players, because it's not just about the standard salary. There are so many other bonuses. There's the sell-on clauses and transfer clauses. The fact that there's also image rights, social media and all those sort of things that have come to the fore. So in these type of situations, to avoid these type of disputes, and we don't know what disputes this is going to become, you need to have expert advice. And that's where football lawyers or agents who are lawyers as well, or agents who've been very experienced, need to be able to nut out a very concise and precise deal where they don't have these sort of disputes. But very interesting to see how the Dembele agent dealt with this, Sissoko. But that's just from a story, from a media article. So only getting that sort of perspective.
Let's shift from that one and let's look at a more positive story. A lot of people are far too quick to focus on the negatives from the agents industry. So we've got another story this week involving a transfer, and it seems to be one where a club, a player, and the agent have all pulled together in the right direction and got the right outcome.
Okay, this is a very interesting one. I've never seen this sort of before in terms of, I would call it one word, an honor, or two words, an honorable transfer. We have a story from this transfer window is the transfer of Moses Caicedo from Brighton to Chelsea. And I'll refer to an article that's got a few quotes that I really want to put forward before we analyze the stories. Chelsea Moses Caicedo, latest agent hails perfect deal as imminent arrival praised for tough Liverpool stance. Neil Foster wrote this piece. It's on the Team Talk website. It mentions that Moses Caicedo has been praised for the way he's stuck to his guns to snub Liverpool and on an agreement to join Chelsea. And from the agent's point of view, and he had an agent, a former Ecuador international called Jorge Guagia, has helped praise on the youngster for the humanity shown during the transfer tussle between Chelsea and Liverpool. And why the transfer tussle? Because it seemed that Caicedo made a commitment to Chelsea, whereas Liverpool came in with maybe a bigger offer, and they agreed with Brighton for the midfielder. However, Caicedo, as it mentions here in the article, committed to Chelsea, and Mr. Jorge Guagia, the football agent, quotes that perhaps another player sees more money and forgets what he previously promised. If he kept his word to Chelsea, that's perfect. That speaks well, not only as a player, but as a human being. So Mr. Gagua is trying to amplify the fact that although there was interest from Liverpool and maybe a bigger fee and bigger fee for Brighton based on this article, that Caicedo, who gave his word to Chelsea, has stuck with that. I'm not saying we don't see that often, but that's quite unique in this space. And also the agent to put that sort of forward. And agents have a big influence on players, and a lot about it is getting the most money. And in this case, it seemed it may have gone the other way, Jonathan.
Yeah, Peter, I think this report would bring a smile to anyone's face who recognises strong principles and honour, especially in the football industry where, I'll say it, it's often in very, very short supply, those qualities. And we've seen from the report there that there's an unfortunate use of term that he snubbed Liverpool. The fact is, I don't believe for 1 minute he really snubbed Liverpool. If the offer was there and he's honouring the original agreement with Chelsea, maybe Liverpool just missed the boat in terms of timing. If they come in at the same time, he would have felt obliged to consider both. Too many people are quick to draw attention to the negative stories of players and agents when it comes to contracts and agreements and transfers, and they ignore stories like this. So it's good that this has got the airtime and the exposure that it deserves. Now, this player is only young, but I believe he's around 21. And it appears that the agents and the player have kept their word to a club on the agreement. And this is based, of course, as you've said, on what's been reported. We don't know if more lucrative offers were made to win over the player or the agent. I take it from some of the reports, they may well have been offered better terms to have their head turned and go to another club. But we don't know that for sure. And that's part of the industry. That happens to try and convince the player to move to one club over another. I think it's great to see, and it re-establishes a bit of faith in the moral compass of some in the football community. If only more agents, and not just the agents, but also players and clubs and club officials, demonstrated similar honesty, goodwill, honour, and dare I say, the football favourite of transparency in this way, rather than, as you might say, some would be blinded by the check.
Yes. If you look at this article, there's a factor of loyalty, as you mentioned, but there may have also been a pre-agreement between Chelsea and the player. And when Brighton were negotiating with Liverpool, maybe they weren't aware of that. I'm not so sure. But it shows loyalty and also shows the agent, if that's the case, saying that, you know, we need to stick by our word and this is the pathway that we've chosen. So without trying to dissuade the player just based on monetary consideration. So quite a rare story. I mean, obviously, this is a story based on reports that we've seen in recent days. Maybe there were more lucrative offers. Maybe there are other factors at play. We're not sure. We're just going with what the articles say and what the agent was quoted, not just in that article, but also back home in Ecuador.
It's safe to say, reflecting back on the episode we did with Jed, it's Brighton's recruitment department coming up trumps again, and the business model there continues to reap rewards in identifying this talent.
So with most of this episode being about all these prospective new agents coming into the market, and some people maybe saying maybe there's too many agents, and some will go as far as say that players don't need agents without fully understanding the role of agents and what value they bring to the table or the different type of agents available out there. A few episodes back, I think it was episode 6, Jonathan, we spoke about reports and articles in the media involving Kevin De Bruyne's contract and negotiations and his reported reliance on data, statistical reports, and having no agent involved, although I believe he had a football lawyer or a lawyer involved. Now, something that didn't make the edits in that show was the research of another Belgian It's a Belgian agent by the name of Stein Francis, who I do know quite well. And in his time as a lawyer and agent, and I think in terms of Wyscout, he's top 50 agent in terms of number of players. I did a bit of research on that. He publicized some research on LinkedIn asking the question of whether players do need agents and the scenarios based on that. And I thought it'd be worthwhile to revisit it as the discussion we had was quite valuable. I just want to go into Stein Francis' comments, and he starts off his piece on do football players really need agents or can they do without? He's based this piece on analyzing the transfer windows and the deals that he's been involved in. So he looked at 61 transactions, of which 39 were transfers and 22 were contract extensions. And this is based on his own dealings and his own agency. And he also looked at what relationships he had with clubs. So his agent's got a relationship with 203 clubs. He defines relationships as getting the correct feedback about a player that had been offered within a reasonable period of time. Now, during January, the last transfer window, he was in touch with 94 clubs, so a bit less of the 50 clubs he knows. Now, his conclusions on whether a player, and I would say more established players or elite players, be like De Bruyne or players in the top five leagues or maybe top eight leagues, whether they need an agent in relation to a deal. He came up with three conclusions. If you want to transfer, then agents, or at least his firm, but agents can have a substantial contribution to your career. So in terms of opening up transfer opportunities and looking at alternative options, agents have an important role. The second, if you want control over your career, if a player wants a little bit of autonomy in relation to that, then they should only work with agents who have the right networking relationships to help with the overview of the situation, where there's possible destinations, possible clubs that they can be pitched to or put forward to, or possible markets. And the third one is where he sort of found, based on his research of the transaction did within his own agency, was if you want a contract extension as a player, agents probably are less added value to your career, especially if you're experienced and you can basically bring your own data in as a player and say, I want an extension, but I want this increase, or I want this period of time, I want these variables or bonuses. So very interesting. And I'll just finalize on this based on his experiences and his deals of over 60 deals. But that's good. Big agencies can do that because they've got data of how many extensions they've done, how many negotiations, how many transfers, and they can actually develop some basic data of where they add value to players. So I think Stein Francis have broken it down on what scenarios players need agents more or rely on agents more than when they can rely on themselves or a lawyer to cut a deal. Jonathan, what's your view on angle by Stein Francis?
I don't doubt the research, but I just think it's a very narrow perspective. And also, it's a very dangerous bit of research in the fact that it can be taken out of context, either by people who don't understand the context of the research and look at it like you did. And it's very easy for people to take elements out of that research, take it out of context to, shall we say, argue the value of agents in football altogether. The first thing I will say is that the data pool there is very restricted. I know you said about it being a large agency, but it's very restricted. We're talking 60 transactions. We know there's been so many transactions in this window thus far that far outstrip that. So is it representative data? The next thing is that every agent is different. We've had a conversation with somebody in the last 24, 48 hours with regards to the pod, and we identified that the difference between agents, intermediaries, brokers, and how agents operate in general. It's very rare you will find two agents who operate exactly the same, provide exactly the level of service. Now, in this situation, we're talking about an agent with a law firm background. And I've commented on this article on LinkedIn, and there's been pieces that I've taken out of it and said, well, that isn't truly reflective of the industry as a whole. So you have agents who will do those transactions, who will just do the deals. And I remember there was an English club chairman and club owner who turned around in an interview and actually said, well, the worst agents I've come across are of such and such player, and they just turn up when there's a transfer window or a contract to be renewed, and they're lawyers. And they just turn up for the signing. They bring no value over the length of the representation agreement with the client, with the player. And that for me is dangerous as well, because the support that a vast proportion of agents offer to players go way beyond the transaction, go way beyond the contract. It goes through that whole, some people use the term holistic. It makes me shudder a bit because people have subjective views of what holistic is. But you're supporting that player throughout, whether it be matters to do with the family, whether it's to do with the household and their family and cars and finance and issues like that. It's not safe to say every agent is the same, much the same as it's not safe to say every player is the same. And you're talking about a very small pool of data here. Also, it talks about the relationship with clubs. So are we talking about agents who represent the clubs and the players, or both clubs and the player, or agents who solely represent the players? Because there's a lot of people who pride themselves on representing the interests of the player as a priority. So I recognise the research. I recognise it applies to that firm and that group of players and that geographic location. But we are talking about a worldwide sport of far more than 60 transactions, agents who all operate differently, clubs who all operate differently. And I just get the feeling it's a very, very, if not narrow, the research and the article looks at it through a prism. So it represents them accurately, but for me, it doesn't represent the industry as a whole, whether it be just within that geographic region. Lawyers who act as agents, it probably doesn't even represent them, because all of the lawyers who act as agents operate differently. And above all, it doesn't represent the agent industry and the value that agents bring to players as a whole.
I'll take your points there, Jonathan. I would say this is a good little piece of research. I have a little bit of a different perspective, because it talks about three different scenarios, but it also talks about that agents can bring a stronger negotiating position for the player. That's sort of the objective of this article, that overall, based on the research, I know it's only 60 transactions, the agent plays a very important role, whether it's a negotiation, whether it's an extension, whether it's a transfer. Overall, a good agent
will add value. But Peter, for those who want to take it, as I said, those who want to take it out of context can quite easily turn around and say, looking at the figures that were quoted, 50% of the deals, a player doesn't need an agent. So what happens 6 months into that contract that there's, I don't know, say the player has an ACL injury that rules him out for 18 months. Well, if the agent's just doing the contract and the renewal, who's going to be there? And I would say a lot of agents have been there where they've had clients who've had that injury and they need that support from the agent just as much as their club to get them through that period. Are we then saying that once the contract's done, there's no need for the agent? You've got agents providing that support to that player, good agents going forward, and yet we've got somebody saying, well, they don't provide any value there. And they might not with every player. Every player might not need that, but that is the service that the agent provides. For me, an agent signs a two-year rep agreement to have the agent represent their best interests, whether it be the club on a negotiation, whether it be the player to the media, whether it be that holistic support to the player as a client. They've got that fiduciary duty. If they are just doing the transaction, fine, go the route of a lawyer, charge an hourly rate, do the contract negotiation and disappear.
I understand that. But right now it's all about data. And when smaller or bigger agencies are looking at their own data and analyzing it and coming up with observations or trends or information, I think that's a good thing. And in this case, Stein Francis and his agency have looked at certain three types of scenarios in a negotiation and have come up with certain positions. And I think that's good, because we don't see enough of that in agency. And we want to see more agencies giving research, because as we know, there's not a lot of research inside the Asian business.
I totally agree. And I think that's a positive. And what it needs to do, and the positive thing out of this research, is this should be the encouragement for other agencies and agents to do similar research with their client bases so that we get an accurate representation of what the industry is truly like, not through a prism or a lens that is limited, or with the greater context of when stats are used in football, especially with the representation of agents, is distorted to suit whatever agenda that they want to. Now, this debate about the value of agents to it will go on and on and on for many years. And I'll put my soapbox away and calm down a little bit now. Nice deep breaths. So the duties and the obligations of agents and the value they bring to the player, to a club, to the sport as a whole will be debated, and it just varies. But as I've said there, it's important to keep in mind that every agent is different and they'll continue to evolve as the industry will. This is a relatively, when you compare it to other industries and even other sports, it's a relatively new and rapidly developing industry. So with that, it's time to bring today's episode to a close after another exploration of the football agent's world on the Agent's Angle. Thank you for joining us. Whether you're a dedicated listener or joining us for the first time, keep in mind that the agent's realm is always evolving. And so are we. I think you'll agree with that, Peter.
We always are. We're always, and we're learning too. I mean, there's so much out there.
And we're listening.
And we're trying to take,
So stay connected, everyone. Stay curious. Please don't forget to subscribe to the podcast on the major platforms such as Google, Apple, Spotify, Amazon, and even some of the more niche podcast platforms. And please mention us to your friends and colleagues, whether they're involved in football or the sports industry, whatever level they're operating at, and those who just have an interest in football. I'm off for a couple of days for a break in the sun, Peter, and escape an unpredictable and usually wet British climate. So it's bye from me.
It's bye from me. But before I say that final bye, is I really like to thank all the supporters and listeners out there. We've had a lot of great feedback. So fantastic. And we're just about to finish the Women's World Cup here in Australia, which has been a fantastic tournament. Finishes this weekend. So bye from me.
And at the time of recording, don't mention the score. Bye, everyone. Take care.
The purpose of the Agent's Angle podcast is to provide news, information and facilitate discussion on regulatory matters, policies, business trends and issues affecting football agents worldwide. The opinions and recommendations presented in this podcast are for general information only and should never be considered legal or professional advice. Furthermore, the views expressed by guests are their own, and their appearance on the program does not imply an endorsement of them or any entity they represent. Thank you for listening.